dear listener, and welcome to 10 Laws with East Forest, a new podcast series that I am launching in order to explore through conversation with people who I think lead intrepid lives outside the box. And through that conversation, I'm hoping that we can learn a little bit about how they got there, where they're going, what they're into, and I would hope pick up a few nuggets along the way. So we're going to explore subjects of ecology and consciousness, nature, spirituality, dogs, whatever comes up, basically. Whatever I'm into, whatever they're into, whatever wants to be talked about. So my first guest is Matt Graham. He's a survivalist, a wilderness expert, someone I've known here in town in southern Utah for a while. And he has a lot of great stories, and he's a great guy and a good friend. But before we get into that, I did want to address this probably, let's call it a small gorilla in the room, about why in the hell I'm doing a podcast and why does the world need another podcast? I can see the cosmic eye roll as we think, oh, great, one more podcast in the world. But let me just address that head on and say the reason I'm doing this is because it just interested me. It's something I've actually been thinking about and working on for a couple years. I think it was 2 years ago that I started recording conversations with people with the intention of launching a podcast, and I didn't do it. I didn't, you know, seal the deal or kind of get things out there into the world because I was sort of afraid, I suppose, about it being worthwhile or having value, perhaps it being judged. I don't know, all those things that come up in your mind. And so I just sort of stalled, but it kept coming back and it kept coming back, and I kept feeling that it did have value. And the reason being is because I meet a lot of interesting people in my life. I feel blessed, or I find them interesting. I'm just in my life when I'm traveling, and I always thought it would be so cool just to sit down and have little conversations, and I could just dig in a little bit and be like, you know, tell me more about this stuff that you're into. Tell me more about how you got to this place in time, this place where you're at. You probably have made some really interesting choices. You've figured some things out for yourself. And I know I can learn from that. And if I even pick up one little nugget from that, that's useful to learn how to live wisely, to learn how to live well. And more than anything, you know, we need stories in the world that are... Well, new stories, right? We need a new story to tell us how to live and or just, you know, inspire us about how we can get there. So it's all about not feeling as alone. And if anything, more than ever with our digital lives and social media, we can use some of these tools, these digital tools like an audio podcast. You can put that on, and hopefully we can feel like we're in the same place together and we're sharing that conversation and that story together. So this is something that I do believe in, and my heart tells me that I want to do it, and it's something that I'm truly enjoy. So I thought, you know, fuck it, let's just do it, and we'll figure it out as we go along. We'll figure this out together. We'll figure out what is of value, how to do it, where to do it, and who to do it with. So thank you for your patience, but also please do forgive any audio issues. Being a, quote, professional that I am with sound, you think I would have some of this shit figured out, but I learned by going through the fire that it's not as simple as I thought to record people just talking in the same room. And there were just issues that I seemingly just... failed to remember about phase issues or echoes and all this kind of stuff. But thank you. I'm sure most people don't even care about that because I do think that the content lives through regardless, and that there's a lot to be garnered, and quickly your brain adjusts and it's all good. But my point is, in my self-deprecating way, just saying thank you for your forgiveness and patience as I do figure this out. I also originally was like, I only want to do this in person. You know, I want to just have conversations face to face, and which is always great. And that's something I got to do with Matt and many of the guests. But I quickly realized that that's obviously not super practical, and it really opens up my options when I can speak to people through Skype and Zoom. So I did a bit of that as well, and I'm also probably going to share other things with you too, like music, maybe some live cuts. I often have recordings from different performances that I have no real way to share. You know, it's not like something I want to release through Spotify or iTunes, and so it's this pressure of like you got to master it and all that kind of stuff. It's like, oh, we can maybe be a bit more casual that way through the podcast, and I could do meditations, whatever really comes up and feels like it would be in service. So I am excited to do this together. I'm coming to you today from Bouldertown, Utah, down here in southern Utah. It's a beautiful day. And last night I was walking around with Matt before we started, and he was showing me some edible plants here. And we got into the new sauna, which was awesome. And that's something that I've just started wrapping up construction on. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful project. Something, you know, I like getting my hands, it's something perfect. You know, the perfect day for me is doing some construction, working with wood, using, you know, numbers and that side of my brain, but the creativity of trying to problem solve and figure out building. And then the second half of the day, working on music, and maybe the last half of the day, some kind of counsel or good hang, maybe a cold beer. So if you like this podcast, I don't have any sponsors or anything like that except for you. So the way you can support me and this new project is, most importantly, to give it 5 stars on iTunes. That makes a huge, huge difference for people just thinking about checking something out. To tell your friends about it, to tell your friends about East Forest, my music, obviously stream the music, buy the music, all that stuff is profoundly helpful to keep this ship sailing straight. But if you really want to go big and if you want to send out some financial support, you can always do that via PayPal at info@eastforest.org. That's also the email that you can just say hello at. And eastforest.org is where you can see live dates, which I have some things coming up around the country. And it's always wonderful to see the community in person. So without further ado, I bring you Matt Graham. He is a wilderness expert. He teaches skills. He does a lot of crazy things to push himself, but they're honestly pretty admirable. And he's been doing this for quite a while. There's a lot to learn from him, and I was really excited that we were able to sit down and have this conversation. We even were able to finish it up inside the sauna, so I hope you enjoy it. And here's Mr. Matt Graham. All right, Matt, thank you. I always like to have people perform minor surgery on themselves before we start talking.
Yes.
That was a deep wound.
That was a deep wound. I lost a whole digit there. I
think you're unsuccessful on your tweezering.
My tweezering and pin. It's one of the many perks to working with friction fires and sticks and stones.
Right. If you don't draw blood, then we can't start.
It's probably an obsidian shard.
Yes. That sounds cooler than like a piece of a beer bottle or something. Cool. Thank you. Thank you for talking with me.
Yeah.
I've been excited to talk to you because you have an interesting life and you've had a lot of interesting experiences, and I think it'd just be cool to like get into that a little bit. You're someone who's, how long have you lived out here in southern Utah?
I've been out here 21 years now.
Really?
Yeah.
21 years.
Yeah.
Huh. So you came out here when you were 8.
No. All right. No, I was, I, not to date my age, but I was in my 20s.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And have you always been right around here in the Escalante area?
Yeah, of sorts. You know, I never really lived in town, but when I first moved out here, I built a traditional Fremont-style pit house up on a mesa. Far away from water, far away from town, far away from everything.
Is that technically legal? Like, can you just live as long as you like out there? Or just sort of like no one bothers you?
Not exactly. I mean, at the time when I moved here, there was some laws with hunting shelters that you could kind of fudge things a little bit. But But nowadays, it's a lot more strict.
Yeah.
But I was up there for a couple years, like, going quite thirsty. So then I realized it was a better idea to be a little closer to water than 2 miles away.
All right. I have several questions, but I want to work backwards here. But I want to know how you even learned to do this, what the urge to do this was, and so forth. But let's start there. Like, I need to go back a little bit to understand this. You grew up in California?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Where, Northern Cali? No, Southern Cali.
Southern Cali. Okay.
So
yeah.
You grew up, I know a little bit about it. Just so you, I think you grew up Christian.
We did, yeah.
Your family?
I went to church, non-denominational Christian family.
Very West Coast, non-denominational Christians.
Yes, it was definitely. We had a cabin up in San Bernardino Mountains that was kind of our summer place and like weekend winter place. And then we had a house, kind of moved around a little bit, but Seal Beach and Huntington Beach.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, what did your mother do?
My mom was a mom for a little while. And my dad, he actually made quite a bit of money by the time he was 23 and some real estate investments, but he was also,
that's unusual.
It is
23 real estate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Some property deals, he just kind of got it at the right time. And
in Southern California.
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
And he also is a very talented architect and has done some really unusual stuff, like not just houses, but like designing roller coasters. He actually designed the roller coaster at Universal Studios, the King Kong ride.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it still operational?
It is, yes. Yeah, no lawsuits to date, so it's still okay.
And wow.
He was proud of that. He said he developed it all the way down to the bad breath and everything.
Isn't that more of an engineering thing than architecture?
Totally, yeah.
So he had that in his background as well?
Yeah, there's, I think so. I mean, there's obviously to do something like that, but yeah, there's things that he didn't talk about, I think, in terms of like his full capacity, but a hard worker, you know, he worked 16 hours a day.
And did you guys spend time outdoors? I mean, you went to this cabin in the San Bernardino Mountains. I mean, where did you start to get this lust for the wilderness and the outdoors and this, even the idea? I mean, I'm trying to connect the dots from that to building a shelter. I mean, you came out here.
Yeah.
Did you come out here because it was sort of wild and lawless? I mean, why here?
Yeah. There was an early spark with the primitive skills. My dad was actually into Ewell Gibbons. So when we go up to the cabin, he'd take me around. He'd show me like the watercress and some of the edible plants. And my love for the outdoors. I think he definitely planted a seed, you know, of some kind.
And I was,
I was always interested in Native American skills. And I went to Indian camp every summer.
You have siblings?
I do. I have two half brothers, but I didn't grow up with
them. Did I say that in the past tense? Did you have? Yeah. Yeah. You have siblings.
I have siblings, yeah.
And are either of them on any path of similar ilk of being out here in the high desert?
No.
What are they up to?
They're in their 30s. They're still living with my dad.
Living the life in SoCal?
Living the life, saving up money.
Endlessly?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. I talked to them a little bit. I think they're just trying to save up to get, you know, to try to actually buy something instead of get into the rent game.
Do you feel like a bit of a black sheep of the family or sort of the white sheep? I mean, you're the one who left and leads a slightly different life.
Yeah, no, big time. I mean, all my family still lives in SoCal, so.
Are they down with this? Are they supportive?
Yeah, I don't think they were. I don't think my dad was at first, just because.
Because you're like, Dad, I'm living in a dugout hut in like Utah, and they're like,
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, I mean, my dad came from a little bit more of a monetary existence, and that was a big part of his life. So to walk away from that and pursue something to, you know, a city dweller, my life appears as I'm a professional homeless man, right?
Right. Did you did you burn your money?
I have. Yeah.
Have you?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. No, I've definitely had my spouts of the whole Call of the Wild for sure.
Fuck the system. Mm-hmm. So, what was it though that I mean? I'm still not sure how you got here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, was you?
Yeah. So. I mean, there's definitely some few gaps in the story, but I left my folks' place when I turned 17. I left early, and I went to Yosemite Valley,
mm-hmm.
and started climbing and learned Native American skills from the Miwok Indians there. And then there was a curator at the museum. He taught me about hand drill fires and sinew back bows, and he was really into Ishi, which was the last Yana Indian. So,
what is that?
Ishi, the last Yana Indian, he was like the last Stone Age man in 1911 to walk out of the wilderness.
Oh, like an actual man?
Yeah.
Oh.
So the supposed last Stone Age man. I mean, obviously, that's just...
In Yosemite Valley?
No, he was actually north of there. He was more in the... I think it's in the Shasta area, but he lived on a... creek called Deer Creek, actually.
No kidding.
Yeah. And they were fishing for salmon and deer and hunting deer and gathering the fruits of the land. But his tribe all died off, and he was alone, I think, if I recall, for quite a while. Eventually he came out of the wilderness.
And you're saying that this friend of yours who worked at the museum picked up skills from him? Is that the idea? Or
no,
he's just telling you about him.
Yeah, he was telling me about, you know, these Stone Age skills and how they were present, you know, less than 100 years ago at that time. He was teaching me about some stuff that was amazing. Like, you know, at the time when you see somebody just take two sticks and spin up a fire, you know, and this was like 27 years ago, you know, back before all these survival TV shows. So
we blame you for it.
Yes.
So were you just camping there, or were you living in town, or you were kind of spending time in Yosemite for the summers, the seasons?
Yeah.
Climbing.
Yeah, I was climbing every day. When I first got there, I did a series of odd jobs, from working in an ice cream place, cafeteria, doing catering functions. And then I settled into the Curry Village Mountaineering store.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there for a year and a half, and climbing every day and mountain running and doing survival, studying plants. And then I kind of went on a little climbing tour around the West and came back. And at that point, I guess I kind of was starting to phase out of the climbing and just getting more interested in the wilderness aspect, because I decided not to go back to work, but more just try to live off the land and roam in the Sierras for a while.
Hmm. What about the winter?
The winter, same thing. You know, I'd do what I could, just hunker down. At the time, I was building natural shelters, but I had like a little mountaineering tent, and mm-hmm. I would just bury it under the snow and pile it up with snow for insulation.
Jesus, man. What'd you do for food?
Now I'm stored up, and yeah, I mean, I tried the whole gamut, you know. I tried to survive on very little, and I would eat pine bark.
And, I mean, how far are you? You're in the Sierras, so you're not that far from, if you really wanted to get supplies, or you could be like, screw this, I'm gonna wait till the spring.
I could pop out, yeah.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I lived in the Sierras a total of 6 years, and at one point I even worked in Mammoth Lakes for a little bit, but uh-huh. I still lived in my little mountaineering tent
really?
The backcountry, and I would run into town to go to work. And
how many girls could you bring back to this mountain tent?
Oh man, I was a virgin forever.
Yeah, it's not like, yo, baby. It's like, we just got to hike in a couple miles and then in the snow.
I had no clue what to do with girls at the time, and I was okay with that, you know, my love at that time was the land for sure. And that was just where my path was for that time in my life.
What do you think spurred such a strong, that's a very strong reaction at a very young age? Was there anything that was seminal that made that happen? Or the way you were brought up, that you're react, 'cause you're sort of reacting against something, mm-hmm. a dominant culture. Mm-hmm. And for most people in their 20s, they're running full speed into it, mm-hmm. right? They want to mm-hmm. play in the fame game, the shame game.
Yeah.
But you did the opposite. Why?
Yeah. You know, before I left Southern California, like I was kind of aggro, you know, at least in like in athletics, you
competitive.
Know, yeah. Like I was a really strong quarter miler, and then I went into doing triathlons and I wanted to be a professional triathlete. And I was just like, I was hormonal, you know, intense, you know, and I was strong. I could have taken all those things somewhere. But when I went to Yosemite, climbing like really softened me up. Like, 'cause when I first started climbing, I tried to apply that same sort of aggro to the rock and it wasn't really getting me anywhere. And,
What kind of climbing were you doing?
At the time I was doing what they call trad climbing, traditional crack climbing, like climbing, no aid climbing, but climbing, you know, some of the longer routes, you know, some of these routes were 15 plus pitches, you know, yeah. These 2000 foot walls.
I think climbing's terrifying. I've done it a little bit. I'm just like, this is madness.
I was terrified of it too. Like I
was so scary.
Yeah. I was deathly afraid of heights when I first started climbing. And, I was aggro. Like at one point, like I even like just gave it up and I was just starting to trail run again. And I was like, oh, maybe climbing's not for me. And then, I sold all my gear. But then I started bouldering, and then I was like, then I started, I don't even know what happened, but I just started free soloing like these easy routes. They're like 5-4. And I'm like, oh, this is cool, you know? And I wasn't climbing aggro anymore. I was meditative because I didn't have a rope on me. It's like, I can't go aggro.
Yeah, right. You got to pay attention, slow down.
Totally. So yeah. Then I was like, oh, that's not bad. So then I did every 5-6 I could find. I'm like, oh, it's not bad. Did every 5-7. Every 5-8, every 5-9, you know, and I was free soloing these 2000 foot walls and,
what?
And just, yeah, I just had this new love for climbing that was a soft approach. In fact, there was a climber in the valley at the time named Peter Croft, who in the '80s, like if you're a climber, you know who he is. He was the world's top free soloer in the '80s. And I'd climb, and Peter was like a little wizard. Like, he'd just show up out of nowhere, mm-hmm. and he'd watch me climb. And then I'd climb, come back down off the wall, and he'd be gone. This happened for a while, like a month. And finally, I ran into his wife, and I was like, hey, Joe, you know, Peter watches me climb once in a while, you know. But then he's gone. And Joe's like, oh, yeah, he talks about you, and he says he likes to watch you climb because you climb like you love the rock.
Ah, that's sweet.
Totally. You know, and that was like a big stepping stone for me, because like hearing that from somebody that's such a, you know, a passionate, strong climber, it's like, okay, I broke the aggro spell, you know, from just like wanting to be
so intense. Like an elder that you respected, saying the right thing kind of was something that helped break a certain spell for you?
I think that was part of it. You know,
Or it was more acknowledging something that had already happened, is like helping you witness it, see it in the mirror?
Yeah, I think there was an acknowledgement happen. But I was feeling that too. I'm like it wasn't just a love for the rock. I realized I was cultivating a genuine love for the land itself. And that's where the climbing became less important, because it really became about, it's not only the rock, but it was like, how do I respect and love the land? I went from being this aggro athlete to somebody that like really yeah. wanted to understand and have a deep connection to the earth and the planet.
Yeah, I found for myself, when I had that same desire for connection to land or place, that one thing that starts to go by the wayside a bit is the need for accomplishment. Mm-hmm. Like, I love to go on wanders, meaning, like, I don't really have anywhere I have to go or distance I need or destination. Mm-hmm. I'm just here to kind of cruise around and enjoy the land, explore things, rest when I want to rest. And that's very different than, like, you have to get from point A to point B but in this amount of time. And maybe do it faster than you've done it before, or push yourself to go further, which is, you know, do that too sometimes. But you just start to reprioritize that, I guess.
Yeah.
It's more about just the experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you haven't lost your sense of internal competitiveness, though. So just as what I know about you is, like, I mean, you push yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I
like, you choose to do things that are not necessarily easy, mm-hmm. where you could choose not to do those things.
Yeah,
and but so there's a reason why.
Yeah, but I think the difference is that I don't push myself to beat anybody.
You trying to beat yourself?
Trying to beat myself or, up? Yeah,
part of you. Yeah, I mean, no, seriously, like,
no, it's I think I'm just always searching for the best version of myself, you know, in connection to the land. And in the early time, like, I was inspired by these crazy endurance stories about, you know, Native Americans running for 5 days straight and, like, covering 500 miles. And mm-hmm. like, that was appealing. Like hearing that they could do it off, like, 5 tablespoons of chia seeds, you know,
And John Muir, apparently, he just got, like, some crackers.
Yeah, breadcrumbs, right, yeah. Right. And I hear all these
stories. In a wool suit.
Yeah. And it's like, I mean, those are, like, all these early survival stories that inspired me, you know, the mountaineers in terms of, you know, how they'd approach the winter survival and all these stories. So I was, like, I was recreating them, you know, in a sense. I was, like, you know, in terms of the capacity that I could do. So I would, like, go out and run as far as I could with no food and see when I would collapse, you know. And
because you just wanted to find your limits?
I wanted to push my limits to the point where I knew that whenever I reeled it back, it would always feel easier.
Do you feel that same sense now of the needing to find the edges of yourself?
Not as much, no. I mean, I think life has various phases, mm-hmm. you know, and I feel like at this phase in my life, like, I have pushed a lot of those outer limits. And there are times when I'm like, I, you know, as I age, like, I wonder, I'm like, oh yeah, what can I do now? You know, it's so, like, every once in a while I do go push it a little bit, but I'm never pushing at the edge of the boundaries that I was in my 20s.
Yeah. Hopefully none of us are. If we are, someone needs to slap us. Bet you're too old.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Well, it's beautiful. I mean, you told me, I want to get into about the time where you spent 6 months out. Mm. That was that when you first got here around that time?
No. I first came here to this land when I was 24. And I came over here because there was a survival school.
Boss.
Yeah, Boulder Outdoor mm-hmm. Survival School. Mm-hmm. And I was in California and saw an ad for mm. the school in a magazine.
And it was right up your alley.
Yeah, I'm like, cool, somebody's actually doing this. You know, I didn't even know that existed. So I called up the school and asked them if I could teach. And they said, well, you got to take a course.
You called them and just asked the teacher.
Actually, I got Dave Westcott on the phone. And he's like, well, who are you?
Yeah, could I come over and teach you guys? You know, yeah. Got a few tips. Yeah. I've been living in a tent in the snow up in the Sierra. So yeah. I had a few things to show you.
I ran across California a couple times.
When was the last time you guys collapsed from running? I did that this weekend. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it was more like, I just wanted, it wasn't like I was like, I want to show you stuff. I just wanted to be part of the yeah, teacher
yeah.
tribe.
Yeah.
But Dave Westcott was totally cool. He's like, come on over. And so I rode my bike over and just, like, I fell in love.
You rode your bike over?
My bicycle, yeah.
From California?
Yep. Nice. tied a little blanket to the handlebars, and it was pretty... It was like bike packing, but, you know, 21 years ago.
Yeah.
And Yeah, I was so aggro. I had a mountain bike with slick tires, and I was pedaling 130 miles every day. So I got here in like 6 days, 7 days.
How much food were you eating?
Oh, I mean, it was a bike ride, so I'd stop at a gas station.
Yeah, you need some calories.
Eat some, yeah, something. Some orange juice, some beans.
Wow. So at some point, you decided that you needed to push yourself further. And you're like, I'm going to go out for 6 months. And you started it, I believe, on the winter solstice around that time.
Yeah.
Which is not an easy time be out, not just for the cold, but there's also not a lot of edible food out there.
All right.
So why didn't you wait till spring? What brought up this inclination in the first place?
Well, it was my typical teaching seasons always started in the summer, and typically I teach summer to fall, but that year I wrote down a series of goals, and I was at the time, like, I'd gone out many times solo for 40 days but never beyond that, and I was teaching month-long courses.
So Bost has a 28-day courses.
And I was feeling like I kind of felt like I was just scratching the surface at the end of all those time periods. I'm like, you know, what else is there? So I was writing down some goals, and I wrote down, I'm going to stay out for 3 months. And I looked at
that. Fuck it, double it.
Yeah, I looked at that, and I'm like, nope, that's not enough time. So I'm like, 6 months. And then I thought about it more, and I thought about my teaching schedule. It ended in November, and I'm like, winter solstice. I'm going to go out. I'm going to come back summer solstice.
Damn, man. So and you didn't come into town?
No towns, no spending money, and most of it was solo. I mean, when I say most of it, it's because, like, I would occasionally bump into somebody, but I didn't see anybody for, like, a legitimate, like, 2.5-3 months during the first.
So you must have gotten hungry. There must have been some time.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, like, yeah. Pushing it.
You know, I packed like a big canvas bag when I left, and I packed rations. You know, half of it was food that I gathered, and half of it was like some leftover Boss rations, like the rice and quinoa and like nuts and stuff. And
were you cooking over a fire, or did you bring fuel?
No fuel, all fire. I had acorns, and I dried nettles, and I dried mint, dried some elk meat, and so I had a good base. You know, I had enough that if I stretched it out real minimal, I could get through the harder parts of the winter.
Yeah, get to like March maybe?
Well, February. Not March, but yeah, like February, later
it's
February.
Still pretty cold, yeah.
Yeah, totally. You know, and then March came, and those food supplies were pretty much out at that point. And March was a tough month. I remember like getting weaker and weaker every day, like just not coming up with enough food. And it got to the point where my sleeping hours were, it had to be at least 18 hours a day.
Oh my God. It's not a good sign.
No. And then when I tried to get up, even though my body was like dwindling, it felt like I was pushing 1,000 pounds just to lift myself out of bed.
I mean, what was there to eat at that time of year?
There wasn't much. Is there
any fish or anything you can trap? Or
I was eating some fish that I had strength to go get. The nettles were just starting to bud, and watercress was just starting to sprout.
Not a lot of protein.
No. So I was eating those greens every day. I was eating fish once in a while, and every once in a while I had just enough strength to go get a squirrel or rabbit, but it was kind of...
What kind of tools did you have to hunt or trap, or you had a knife?
I used the atlatl to fish, and I got skilled at both the atlatl and the javelin for fishing, so I was... Had a really
like a spear?
Yeah.
Just throwing a spear.
A really short throwing spear. Like I literally, it actually became a game for me because I had, first I had a 6-foot long spear.
These are creek fish, right?
Creek fish, yeah. And eventually I got so accurate at throwing that, I kept shrinking it for a challenge.
Even though you're dying of starvation, you're like, yeah, why not? Just make this a little harder.
Yeah.
Well, ride that edge.
The fishing wasn't hard to do, but I also like recognized, I don't know what it was, whether it was mercury or something else, but I recognized I could only eat so much fish before my body.
Mercury retrograde? No.
Yeah, I'm starting to glow out there, you know.
So what? It just got into spring and then you had a little more to eat and you turned the corner?
Yeah. It was more than that. I felt like during that time when like my body was getting weak, I was losing a lot of weight. Like I'm sure if I had put myself on a scale at that time, I probably would have been 120.
What'd you start at?
160.
Oh my.
So
it's bad news, Bears.
Yeah. A lot of weight loss.
Scary stuff. Must have been screwing with your mind.
Yeah. I remember during that phase, like some really interesting detox was going on. Like, so I hadn't seen a dentist in like eight years, and I had a bunch of tartar on the back of my teeth, and it started coming off in like sheets. I was like spitting it out for like a week and a half.
Okay.
Like just these little chunks of tartar. And I'm like, wow, this is weird.
Sure. It wasn't like a tooth.
No. And I'm spitting this out. And then after a couple of weeks went by, all of a sudden, like there was no tartar on my teeth and my mouth tasted like candy. It was like sweet.
Okay. Are you trying to say that this is like a form of having good dental care as opposed to just getting a cleaning? Or,
well,
I mean, I'm all for like no x-rays and stuff. But,
like, yeah. I mean, yeah, sure. It's one way, but no, it felt like I was going through this like heavy, heavy detox.
Yeah,
I couldn't lift my body out of bed. Tartar was coming off my teeth. And then all of a sudden I had this sweet taste in my mouth and my strength returned within a few days.
Did you eat new things at this point?
No, that's the bizarre part of it. Mm. I was still only eating maybe 500 calories a day. But all of a sudden the strength came back and I felt strong. My senses felt open. Felt like I could hear, see things, smell things that I hadn't seen before.
How far were you from the closest town if you needed to go in?
At that point, I was only 5 miles away. So I could have broken and walked in.
And you never did.
No.
Wow.
But, and then at this point too, it's like I got over this deep sort of cleanse, and then also it was warming up. Animals were starting to move around and things started to get a lot easier with hunting and everything like that.
So, I mean, I keep going back to this, but obviously in this process, there's a deep, deep pushing of limits. I mean, you, for instance, you were really emaciated. You needed things. You could have used. There's no rule book to say, hey, I'm just going to go get some more rice in town and come back. Mm-hmm. But you didn't. And there's something about you, again, that's looking to find the edge of what's possible for you. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's not just physical, but that's something emotional. There's something spiritual about that. There's something about just exploring what your own discipline is. Mm-hmm. That's very disciplined.
Yeah, but
that's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to observe.
Well,
I
hear what you're saying.
Behind the, it's an amazing story, but behind that, I'm like, this is a really interesting motivation. That's an extreme act of getting away.
Mm-hmm. See, I hear what you're saying, but I didn't look at it like that. I looked at it as we as a species of humanity simply lost that practice and lost that discipline. And I was trying to find it.
So it's an extreme act of diving in then, in a sense. It's like you're going deeper into what it means to be. And you're kind of saying like you weren't in touch with the part of your humanity that you wanted to be in touch with, that most of us aren't.
Yeah. For me, like actually like a driving force, honestly, was I wasn't trying to like deny culture, deny where humanity was going.
Mm-hmm.
I was simply looking at humanity as a whole and feeling like nobody else is doing this. Nobody else is understanding the roots of where we came from. And I think part of it was ego. Part of it was like, you know, just finding a way to be different.
And it's something from your youth, too, that you're talking about.
Like yeah.
That it's a bit of aggro in that of for yourself, sure. You know, internally with yeah. yourself.
But honestly, like I'm just being honest with the process. I think a part of it was ego, but not the majority of it.
Well,
like I sincerely felt like we as humans were, all of us were leaving it, and it felt like my duty. I felt like I was born, like that was part of my mission in life was to go tap back into those deep earthen roots and really understand what we left behind.
Well, thank you for doing it for us, for picking up that baton so I don't have to go out there for 6 months. I'll do a week trip. How's that sound?
Yeah, you better.
I'd love to do a walkabout. You know, I've
yeah.
done loads of backpacking, but I haven't done much where I do a lot of foraging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I'm a little scared because I know before we were doing this, we were walking around my land here and you're pointing out the wild onion, but then next to it, what did you call it? The death, what's it called?
Death canvas and then the spiderwort, which
oh, that's bad too?
No, spiderwort's good.
I don't like anything that involves spiders, frankly, but no, the fact that there's a plant called the death anything next to the tasty onions and I'm supposed to just like, it's a little scary. It's a little intimidating, you know?
No, it's all reachable. It really is.
Yeah. Well, it's good to have someone to at least tell you, like, start here. Don't eat the death thing. It's step one.
Yeah.
Did you ever, when you were out there, mess around with any psychedelic plants like Datura or anything like that? Or have? I mean, at that time, but
yeah.
You ever been out?
No, you know, starvation was enough of a hallucinogenic in itself. Like, I never really felt like I needed it. I did. I actually accidentally took Datura once. And
how does that happen?
You
slipped and fell and
no, it's
smoked a pipe.
Kind of embarrassing. Actually, it's funny because when you talk about like misidentifying plants,
yeah.
I was digging up a fire pit in a big, gigantic like licorice patch. Uh-huh. And licorice around here doesn't taste very good.
Uh-huh.
So I'm digging it up, and then all of a sudden this, like, super plump licorice root pops out, and I'm like, whoa. I was like, oh, that's interesting. So I took a bite, and I'm like, whoa, that's actually pretty good. So I took another bite, and I'm, like, chewing it up, and then I'm like, Matt, you know it's not licorice root. So I, like, look around, and, like, 20 feet away from me is a little Datura plant. So I go over there, and I dig up the roots and realize they're kind of running over there. And,
wow, they go that far.
Well, no, I don't know. It was this different plant, you know, like an older one.
Right.
But I matched up the roots and I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, I took Datura. And I was actually with a friend of mine and I told him, I was like, dude, you got to keep an eye on me.
Yeah, heads up if I get a little wacky.
I don't know what's going to happen. And we had been out for over a month at that time. So he was super lethargic too. So he took a nap. And then I went down and went spear fishing, and
you were spear fishing like purple dinosaurs in the water.
Pretty much something. I was like, it was really weird for like 5 hours. Like I would look at a mountain like a long ways away,
uh-huh.
And I'd see every layer of the mountain from miles away all the way up to like within inches of my eye. And then the same thing with the water. I saw like every layer of the water all the way up to my...
Well, that sounds sort of like an advantage for hunting.
No, I didn't get a single fish. It was like wigging with my visuals.
Can't tell what's what.
No, it was not a good thing. And it was a little scary because I was like, all right, you know, when's this going to stop?
Yeah, where's it going to go too?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't have much interest in Datura. It's a plant I deeply respect, but mm-hmm. I won't even touch it if I see it out. It's too much. It's such so powerful.
It's powerful. I've had friends that have had really bad trips on it.
Yeah, it's got a darkness to it, a power to it that mm-hmm. It's not something that I am drawn to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know someone who grew it in their garden intentionally, not to use, but to, as like a power plant, but they wouldn't touch it. And so it was, everything was like about like working with the plants around it. And
Yeah. People use it for like a muscle salve, like topically, it's sometimes mixed in, but it's, you know, after that experience, like I never had any desire to go back and actually try a different dosage or anything. Like,
what other psychedelic, are there other psychedelic plants or fungi in this area that were ever, at all that you know of?
I don't think traditionally. I mean, of course there's psychedelic mushrooms you find
on, they grow here?
On cow patties.
Sure.
But
I had a giant mushroom that grew right here in the middle of a sage plant. It was about a foot tall. I don't think it was psychedelic, but I think it was a bolete or something.
Yeah, it could be.
But I thought it was rather auspicious. It grew like right when I got here.
Yeah.
I found it in the sage plant too. I thought that was cool too. That was like inside a sage plant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. But you know, I never had desires for psychedelics growing up. I actually didn't even drink alcohol until I was 26 years old. And
man of contradictions.
Well, I didn't eat psychedelics. Like I just felt like my life was always a dream. You know, I was like, why alter that reality? Because it's already pretty potent and deep.
Did it feel like a dream though? Once you went into these places where you're living more outdoors, was that even when you were growing up in California, felt the same way? Was there a shift?
I've always felt a little different as a kid, for sure. But yeah, being outside definitely had a pretty had more of a canvas, I guess, to express that. Just being outside, immersed full time.
Some people say that when they live more off grid or get into the rhythms of nature, after a few years of that it starts to open things up within themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Their creative potential, or they start like channeling, or their life is more dreamlike. Have you experienced anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say just from living outside, but definitely from living, going on long walkabouts and living as a hunter-gatherer, for sure. I mean, there becomes this potency too in your dream world where your dreams become so vivid at night. Sometimes it is hard to tell the difference between your waking hours and your dreaming hours.
Well, this ties right into what I was talking about with Matt the other day for the podcast about dreaming and reality and what is that. And
yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm also curious, when you were out there, any of these times you've been out, what kind of stuff has come up for you? Like this podcast series it's riffing off the idea of the 10 laws and that song, that one of the East Forest songs that's about sort of a hunter-gatherer's code of 10, which is appropriate for you. But it's about a friend of mine who created a path, a set of stars to keep his life on track. Some maxims for his own life. And I mean, what are things that came up for you when you were out there that maybe have been integrated into your own life as life lessons, or even practices that maybe you've brought into your life, stuff that you might do or not do?
Yeah. I mean, there's quite a few things that when I started this, I was really just trying to understand a more kind way to treat the planet and live on the planet.
Yeah.
You know, and that was something I learned from my 6 months solo. Like I came back and I had a little bag of trash that was like the size of a grapefruit, you know, and then the next day I made a bag of trash that was three times that big.
Yeah.
Just by going to the market and splurging.
Right.
And I'm like, wow, you know, for 6 months, you know, I was able to be pretty kind to the earth. And it wasn't like I was raping the land like people might say, like, There's this bad rap sometimes that hunter-gatherers get. It's like, well, you know, the reason people sometimes say because we're such big numbers on this planet, that's why we have to like transport things from China and do all this stuff. But the reality, what I learned being out there was once you really live in a spot for so long, the land just like, it automatically teaches you to respect it. It takes time, but like you learn how to collect plants that actually increase the harvest. You learn how to fish and hunt in a way that's respectful and doesn't damage the populations.
Well, just localizing.
Right. You see the impact.
It also is probably has less impact.
Right.
Than,
it has less, but you also see it. Like we're so far removed from the impact that we don't understand how much we're actually damaging, trying to get these foods to us from overseas.
Right. There's this idea of companies being responsible for the disposal of their products, too. You ever heard that idea? It's like whether it's factored into the price in that sense.
Yeah.
Which probably just be passed to the consumer, or they're literally responsible for the complete life of what they create, which is completely the antithesis of how we do things now.
Yeah.
Everything's very disposable. We don't know where it comes from. We also don't really know where it goes when we're done with it. Our trash and stuff.
Right. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Like when I was in Copper Canyon with the Tarahumara Indians, when I first got there, I was a little taken back because like, you know, they'll have a bag or a bottle and they just throw it on the trail.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm like, well, this is kind of weird. But then I noticed like another native will come by and be like, oh, I need a water bottle. And he picks it up, you know, or they have like an old shirt or something. And they just throw it down on the trail. And because they don't have like trash facilities, but they're still reusing this junk at some point.
Yeah.
Or what, you know, we would consider junk.
I was going to go throw some more wood on the fire and then we can do a little bit more. Is that cool?
Sure.
All right. All right, we're back. We got that sauna cooking. You're the first guest to come to the sauna.
First guest?
That's like podcast. Oh shit, that's not true. Well, because I talked to Day Morning Altars, but it wasn't like the same time.
Yeah.
So this is more like the full meal deal experience where it's like it's all part of the thing.
Yeah, it's been nice, fully encompassing.
We can take
awesome,
this into this
awesome
that's
tacos.
My goal.
Yeah. And we're you can actually bring these mics into the sauna.
Well, I'm going to try.
Cool.
I would like to. Why not?
Yeah.
We'll wrap it up in there in a second.
Okay.
But here's what I wanted to ask you. When you've been out there some of these times or some other times, there must have been a few occasions besides like being emaciated and starving that you've had some scary experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone loves a good story. And I was curious. This is partially for my own sake. You ever seen a cougar out here? A mountain lion?
I've seen a lot of cougars out here.
A jaguar? A lot, really?
Yeah.
This is my thing with the cougars out here is like, I'll see like massive prints, real fresh prints, or I'll hear like other people telling me what they saw like just that day or like right where I am. Like, oh, there's an 8-foot cougar like, right. over there, you know, or this morning, and oh, there's a den right over there. And like,
yeah.
I'm sort of mesmerized by mountain lions because
I love mountain lions.
They're gorgeous, but the fact that you probably would never know they're watching you, the fact that they attack from behind and catch you.
Well, and above too. Like that's why we don't see them, because a lot of times they'll find a little bit of a high perch, and we don't look up, and deer don't look up very often either.
Right.
So mountain lions take advantage of that. They'll sit kind of like up on a boulder behind or tucked in a little tree, and
at least they have plenty of deer to eat here.
Yeah, they do. So there's no shortage of that, and they've never been known to attack anybody here in this region.
Right. But you have seen some.
I've seen quite a few.
You ever been cornered at all or anything like that? You're in between a cub and a mama?
No. I had one almost step on me in the middle of the night, though.
What?
Yeah.
You were just asleep and you woke up and there's a mountain lion in your face?
Yeah, I was sound asleep. I was kind of in a PNJ forest and the wind was, my head was faced up the canyon. The wind was hitting the top of my head. There was a pretty strong breeze. And I remember, you know how that sensation when you're like in deep sleep, but you're trying to wake up, but you're so tired you can't?
like you're starving to death?
No. It's
no
like,
math.
Really?
I guess so, yeah. There are times where like when you're in deep sleep, it's like a grogginess.
Yeah. But like it's almost like when somebody wakes you up, but you're not ready to be woken up.
Yeah.
So I had that sensation, like I needed to wake up, but I was having a hard time doing it.
Yeah.
And I'm like just slowly starting to come out of that. And then I hear this like step right next to my head.
Next to your face.
Next to my face. Yeah. So I spun around like super fast, like really attentive. And right there with like me to you, which is what, 3.5 feet. I'm staring at this big head of a mountain lion.
It must have startled the lion.
And this lion was stout. Like, it was full-blown, like, strong adult lion. And he was same thing, too, like, full-on tense. So, like, I was like, you know, if one of us doesn't relax, this is not going to go good. Mm-hmm. So actually, like, I dropped my shoulders and, like, relaxed my whole body. And he mirrored me. It was really cool. Like he was like full on.
And then
like,
he became your pet. And then you were like, no. He-Man, and you had Cringer.
I wish. No, the story's not quite that romantic. But he relaxed and he looked at me for maybe another like, felt like a minute, but it was probably like another
longest like 10, minute in your life.
10 seconds or so. And then he just like slowly backed up and he went away. And
wow.
It's kind of hard to sleep the rest of that night.
Oh my God.
But in the morning, I got up and I looked at the tracks, and he didn't know I was there until that step that I heard. Like, he was just casually strolling along. He couldn't smell me, see me.
Well, there aren't a lot of people out there, you know, just sleeping on the rocks.
Right.
Wow, man. I've had one experience sort of with the mountain lion. I was in Mount Jefferson Wilderness in Oregon, and I was brushing my teeth at night, and it was, I don't know, 10 or something. And I'm just standing like in an alpine meadow, brushing my teeth. And I, like in the darkness, I see what appears to be a cat like doing that lumbering with the shoulders, you know, do that kind of cat thing.
Yeah.
And it's coming directly towards me, like making a beeline, but walking.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the adrenaline starts going. And I immediately think like, don't look afraid, even though you're afraid, because you got to appear like calm, because what am I going to do, right?
Yeah.
Stab it in the eye with my toothbrush, you know? So, like, and I'm just full of adrenaline and trying to look cool.
Yeah.
Just trying to be like, yo, just I'm just chilling in this alpine. It's all good, mountain lion. And it comes up. It's getting closer and closer and closer until it's like 3 feet and it's coming right up to me. And then I see it has a collar on and it's like a yellow lab.
It just
gotten loose from some other backpacker. And he's like, I'm cruising. He's like, hey, what's up? And he's just like, how you doing? And he's just the happiest like dog. And I'm just like, dog, what the fuck are you doing? And then he just took off and I'm like, he's going to go freak somebody else out. He's just cruising around looking for food.
That's a big lab.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, it had that yellow color and he was kind of, I think he was a little afraid too. He was doing that walk, but he was excited too. So he's coming kind of quick. Like some guy, I'm gonna go say hi. So that's my experience. I'm sure I've had some mountain lions looking at me from time to time, but I never knew. You know, can feel them sometimes.
My favorite experience with a lion that was actually when I was in Sequoia National Park.
Uh-huh.
There was a trail that I used to run like four times a week, and it was I think it was 3.5+ miles, maybe almost 4. Down to this river bottom, and I'd run it before work. I'd go down there and then climb back up. And I was like the only one on the trail for some reason.
How far is this run?
It's like almost 8 miles total.
For work, a little 8 mile run?
Yeah.
Why not? I do that all the time.
Yeah, well, that was my short run. Then the other days I'd do a 20 mile run.
Of course, see if you could collapse.
Yeah. But
that's that you'd push yourself. It's like, how far can I run? And then you see if you collapse at work. It's like, how long can I work?
Yeah. Oh, no, that's my short weeks. I mean, at the time I was like running 120 miles a week when I was training hard. But
that's, I mean, you've done some long distance.
Yeah.
Marathon type, ultra marathon running.
Yeah. A lot of long runs.
But
so one day I was coming around the trail and there was a mountain lion like just sitting on the trail. and it was sitting on the trail facing the direction I was running, but was looking over its shoulder.
At you?
It was literally waiting for me. Like, I came around the switchback and it was just like chilling, kind of chill body. And it looked at me, and then it got off its hind legs, kept looking at me, and then like wished its tail a couple times.
Yeah.
Looked at me again, took two more steps, looked at me again, and wished its tail. And I was like,
Was it flirting?
No, like its body language was like relaxed, but also it was like it felt like it was saying, come over here. So,
oh my God.
So I go trot over.
I got some buddies over here.
Over there.
Yeah.
To this mountain lion.
And then you're madman.
And then we start running down the trail together. Like, he's my pet.
Oh my God.
It was crazy. So I'm watching this, like, it was beautiful. I'm watching the back of this mountain lion, like muscles just rippling. And he's just like loping, like he could like probably run like three times as fast, but we're running like jogging, you know, pace, like maybe 8 to 10 miles an hour. And we go down the trail, and he's just staying on the trail. And every once in a while, he just kind of looks over his shoulder. And then we do a switchback, and we do like two switchbacks, like two big switchbacks. And we actually traverse eventually under this big granite cliff. And going back on the third switchback, he stops and he looks at me again. And then he looks straight up at the cliff we just traversed under. And he looks at me again, and he like kind of wished his tail. He looks straight up at the cliff, and then he just shot up it like a lightning bolt.
What is he, like an alien? And that's where you pointed your sword at him and said, I have the power of Grayskull.
No, that's when I said, you win. I'm impressed with your climbing skills. But totally, like, the whole time.
Was he like slightly domesticated? Is this like a... Was this? Sequoia?
No, Sequoia. Total wild. He just was having a playful day. Like, so that trail, since I was the only one running it, I'm sure he was like watching me, like probably for weeks, if not like a couple months. And eventually he's just like,
so I like your style. You run every morning.
Yeah. Like I'm going to go play with this dude.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I'm not a cat person. I'm a dog person. So yeah. I don't even understand cats.
Yeah.
This is basically a giant cat. So it's like the body language of it. Mm-hmm. Like dogs, I got it. The tail, a whole bit. But there aren't any wolves, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I still wouldn't feel confident if I saw a wolf.
Yeah.
You ever seen a wolf?
No, I've actually never seen a wolf.
I wouldn't want to see a wolf because they're crafty. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like coyotes in the sense they'll try to trick you.
I would definitely... for some reason, I've always been comfortable around a mountain lion, but I probably wouldn't be as comfortable around a wolf.
You had any issues with coyotes?
No.
Being weird?
No, not weird. I've had them kind of...
They get close sometimes.
But yeah.
I had a friend, he's from Jersey, and mm-hmm. he went camping out in Jersey, and he's not a camper, and it's my old roommate, and he told me that, like... He got surrounded by coyotes, and he called 911. And the operator's like, what do we do? He's like, you tell me what to do. Nobody knew what to do, because this is like New York City metro area.
Yeah.
I think they decided that he should throw something at them.
They should have just got a recording of a mountain lion and blasted it on the phone. He could hold the phone up.
Pull up a YouTube video.
So yeah.
I used to do that with my dog. I'd pull up YouTube calls of wolves.
Yeah.
And you just watch the dog tilt its head back and forth. Like, how did you get a wolf in that device? Yeah. You're a crafty, crafty one, master.
Actually, when I was in Yosemite, I was at a backcountry campground. This one guy had a recording of different animal sounds. And this bear came in and was harassing his camp one night. And he put on a mountain lion. And the bear went aggro on him. It sounded like he was shredding his tent up.
Whoa.
It did not work.
You don't want to mess with bears, man.
I know.
There are a lot of... there's black bears everywhere, which I was never too concerned about. I was more just sort of... I'm really good about clean camps and keeping mm-hmm. my food away from me at night. But... Mm-hmm. Did some backpacking in Glacier.
Yeah.
And there's so many people that go there, and you have to permit it the whole bit, and they tell you which... you have to sort of camp in their backcountry camps because of the grizzlies there. And there's... They obviously know you're there, and they want them to not get used to scoping out your food. And so we I woke up one morning and I would have my pack like in that little vestibule at the tent. You know what I mean? I have a tarp tent. You ever seen those?
Yeah, yeah.
Great tents. So it's like there's a piece of mesh and then the pack's right next to me, but there's a cover over it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I woke up, my pack was gone. So I'm like, A, that's a problem. B, oh my God, like a bear like pulled out my pack to peep it out and took it somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just, you know, it's the morning. And so I'm real slowly, kind of zippy thinking, it's just like right there, like munching through my bag. And there's nothing in it that I remembered. But sometimes people will leave like a little piece of jerky in there or something, right. Or a little Clif Bar.
Right, or some odors.
Yeah. And I unzip the thing and I find the pack and it's just like across the way. And I see a deer. And they were like, they were interested in the sweat, like the saltiness of the sweat. And they were eating my straps.
A deer, that's pretty bizarre, actually.
It is bizarre, but at least it wasn't a grizzly bear.
Yeah.
You know, everywhere, it's the same thing like the mountain lion. Everywhere I'd go, someone would say like, I swear to God, like you'd see these steaming, heaping piles of bear shit. And it's all blueberries, which is a good sign.
Yeah.
But steaming, meaning like it was just here.
Right.
You know,
right.
And one time I'm hiking down the trail and I see a rock with like a note under it. And there were these people hiking before me, and they're probably 15 minutes in front of me on the trail. So I assume it's from them, and I pick up the note, and it says, on your left is a family of bears. And so you do that whole thing, you're just kind of slowly turning to the left, you know. It was up too, because you know, I was used to looking up. I could have walked right by it. Nothing there, of course. So you know, it's just like you always knew, or you'd run into someone like, did you see that pack of grizzlies? Where? It's right there, heading down the hill. No, I don't see it. Where were they going?
Yeah, did they put a time on the note?
I think they might have, you know, or something. But, I mean, it's the same thing. We're seeing these steaming piles of shit.
And, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's worse. It's like seeing the animal, hopefully in the distance, or it's just like, you know, the smells, the prints, the scat.
Yeah.
All around you. It's like they're playing with your mind. Yeah. I don't know. I've been more terrorized by like chipmunks and stuff, frankly, and crows. And
yeah, stealing food from your camp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you wanna sauna it?
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, I know we're gonna sauna. See, we can do this for a little bit before these things get too hot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Sound good?
Yeah. So, how hot we get in the sauna?
It gets up to like 165. I can't seem to max it out past that. It's not the largest room, but I like doing the cycles of that into the cold dunk. And
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty nice little setup you got there.
Well, it's not even finished.
Yeah.
But it's functional.
Handcrafted of your design.
Yes. Me and Omar.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like designs where you don't have designs. You just kind of, we both stood there and like, what do you think? Like 12 feet? You're like, all right, we start building. Yeah. And you start building, you're like, wait, no, we should have like put this thing over here and this through there. But yeah, I also thought it'd be cheaper. But out here, man, it's been a learning curve of materials. And
so, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited to go in there and sweat a little bit.
It's not a competition. We don't have to faint. We don't have to like push our limits, man. God. This is just pure pleasure and good health. Good times. Okay?
What do you think? I'm a masochist or something?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. It is hot in here.
It's warm, yeah.
I think we should do this before I get it, like,
yeah, for sure.
Just another, like, few minutes to finish up the conversation. Do you ever do things that sort of, like saunas or things that sort of, I mean, I suppose, like, running and all these things are ways of pushing your consciousness to find clarity, but is that sort of a practice for you?
Yeah, I suppose some type of, whether it's running in summer heat or winter sauna. I definitely have always appreciated the saunas. When I was guiding with Boss, I'd always end my courses with the sauna for the students.
Did you make a sweat lodge, or did you guys have a sauna?
More of a sweat lodge, so.
Traditional style, like willows and...
Yeah, I built them with willows and then cover them with tarps. And then later, I built more of a traditional Navajo-style sauna on the land. So it was actually basically logs that were cut to form a teepee shape, and then it's packed with bark and then clay on top of that.
That's a little more permanent, huh? Like, it takes a little while to build.
Yeah, definitely. It took a few days to put together, a pretty strenuous labor.
Yeah, I mean, do you find that, like, when you go running or you do these different things, that there's a, like, I know for me, the real reason I built this sauna was for mental health.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. Actually, the second reason was physical health, because I know it takes a lot of great research about boosting your immune system and mm-hmm. life longevity and toxins and flushing your lymph node system and so forth, but...
Yeah.
For me, it's a great way to, like, reset mentally.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. There's something, especially when you add, go in here, you get that heat, and then you add that cold plunge in the end, whether it's a cold shower or a cold pool, river, or snow bath.
But maybe I'm discovering, just in talking about it, like, this similarity of how you're talking about challenging yourself. Because essentially in a sauna, you're pushing yourself a little bit. You're sweating out of your body's comfort zone physically. And by doing that, there's a certain benefit. And I'm sitting here saying how it helps me sort of drop anxiety a bit.
Yeah.
Or if I've got some mental patterns going on, it can help me sort of drop them.
Yeah. Yeah, I could totally.
Or lessen them.
I could see that for sure. There's some interesting research that I've been told by students anyways about how hot and cold affects the mood, you know, that we're in. And I definitely think there's something to that. Like, if you go to that extreme, it's almost like you're pushing that heat, that sort of intensity or that mental tension out of you.
But what happens to your mind when you're going through these intense things, like long distance running, or just anything that involves endurance or stress on your body?
Yeah, I think, well, for me, I've always found that, I guess because the experience is so hard, the only way to be present with it is to surrender to it, to not fight it, not bring that emotional status to the point where it is like, oh, this hurts, you know, my legs or my lungs are burning or whatever, but actually more surrender to the experience. And since so much of what I do is land connection, it usually, part of that surrender is allowing the land itself to speak to me rather than going so much internal.
Does the way the land speaks to you, is it through sort of feeling more than thought?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it certainly, it's not, obviously it doesn't speak to me through my own thoughts. It's more of a...
Meaning, like, when you can slow down your own thought process, you can hear better the voice of the land, so to speak.
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely something to that. And I think that's why approaching the land from a hunter-gatherer standpoint always has a very distinct voice, because you're in a sense leaving all the gadgets and the tools behind. So you're stripped down to your raw essence, you know. And a lot of times I would just go out in a breech cloth and a stone knife, you know. So I'm just
really... What's a breech cloth? It's like a loincloth?
Loincloth, yeah. Like,
so like if I rolled up on you in the wilderness, you'd be cruising around in a loincloth with a knife?
Yeah, a stone knife sometimes.
A stone knife. Yeah. That's full caveman style.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could call it caveman style.
It's hardcore. Do you have shoes?
So, I mean, I go barefoot a lot of times, but then I'll sometimes have, like, rawhide sandals or, you know, elk skin neck sandals.
Wow. Yeah, you introduced me to those Luna sandals. I love them now.
Yeah, the same style, but just made primitively.
Oh, okay. Yeah, those are great. You can run in them too.
Yeah, you can cover some miles in those. And that's what the Tarahumara were, you know, doing all their long forays, you know. And some of their historical records say that these men were covering 500 miles in 5 days.
Really?
Yeah.
Where are they going?
Either delivering messages or they're just going to an event, another
party
distance away. Sometimes they're carrying goods for people. The miles, I do have to be honest though, like my research, my time down there, I found that the miles were not translated. So when you read accounts about this, they're actually speaking about kilometers, but we throw in miles.
Either way, they're covering some ground. I don't really care how far they're going. It's just kind of like...
It's a long way. I mean, they're covering 60, 70 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty... Yeah. It's impressive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know when you do a lot of through hiking, like on the PCT, you got to be doing at least 20 a day. You know, and on flat ground, probably up to 30. But if you figure 10 hours of hiking, most people are about 2 miles an hour. You just got to, that's 20 miles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Full day of work.
Yeah, for sure. And nowadays, there's so much ultralight gear and people doing all those through hikes trying to push their own limits, you know, and 30 miles a day is really common nowadays.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if common's the right word, but there's a subset of people who that's common, but yeah. I mean, people with Fitbits counting their steps, you're probably even breaking 10,000, you know.
Right.
Which I think about 20,000. How much is a mile, roughly, in steps? 5,000?
In steps. Let's see. A step is a yard?
No way. Average gait is probably... maybe it's a yard. Let's say it's 3 feet.
Yeah, so it'd be like 1,600 steps a mile, if that's the case.
Miles, what, 5,200 some feet? Is that right? 5,200?
Yeah, it sounds about right. It's, what is it, 1,600 and, 1,700 and... God, my math brain's not working. It's somewhere between...
It's the song, man.
1,700 miles.
Yeah, normally, like, I can calculate, like, mad things.
Yeah.
And
but it's 1,600 meters in a mile.
Okay. So, anyway, I don't even know why we're talking about that. I remember. I'm just starting to really sweat here.
It's working. The delusion's kicking in.
We haven't. Yes, I feel the earth. I'm not even thinking. I know, I haven't even put any water on this yet. We got to kick up the sound system in here, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we can wrap it up, man. How do people find you? Because I know we didn't really talk about this much, but your sort of main dedication these days is teaching, mm-hmm. or your passion, I should say.
Yeah.
Am I getting that, I believe, right? You told me that.
Yeah. I mean, my main passion is teaching, but also... still continuing to connect with the land and bringing things full circle. Like I have this goal this year, starting in the summer solstice to the winter solstice, which is the other 6 months a year, to make a commitment to not use any monetary currency and no motorized vehicles. So
just those two things?
Just those
two
things.
Come on, man. No, I'm kidding.
So what that means for me, I'm still going to document it. And I want to spend a lot more time hunting and gathering and also working more in like local community, working on the barter system and with friends mm-hmm. and stuff and trade and craft. And
you live in the gift. I mean, beyond barter is just sort of constantly in the mode of giving.
Uh-huh,
yeah. And it's not always a direct path how the gift comes back to you. But that is be wonderful to see your own experience if the golden rule just mm-hmm. flourishes when you truly like let it go and live in it like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited about it. And I feel like it'll be nice to tap into my 6 months solo and reflect on that, because that was 10 years ago. And doing this now, which encompasses the other half of the year, so it's perfect.
Yeah.
I'd like to write about it and mostly just connect with the land so I continue to have stronger instruction and lessons and gifts and things to bring to students when I do teach.
So you're going to be riding bikes and walking?
Yeah.
And flying in your dreams?
Yes. So maybe flying in real life. We'll see.
That'd still be pretty badass skill that you pick up.
Yeah.
That'd be a great thing to teach. So if people want to, where do you teach? How do people find you? How do people link up with you?
Yeah, well, currently I don't have a website up yet, but all my classes are available on social media, like Facebook, Instagram. It's Matt Graham Earth Skills.
And on both?
Yeah, one's Matt Graham Earth Living Skills Facebook, and then the Instagram handle is Matt Graham Earth Skills. And
Didn't it used to be something else? Did you change it? Wasn't it Matt Graham Survivalist?
Yeah, that was the original handle. I didn't get on social media until this summer, so somebody else actually started it as a fan page. But then I took over and changed the name of it.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it's available there, and I'm currently teaching through the Boulder Mountain Guest Ranch. And
right, which is where I do the retreats that I do.
Yeah.
And you led a hike at the last one, or the one before that?
Last
one, I think.
Yeah, and as you know,
I remember I gave you a first aid kit, and you were like, yeah, we might need this. And I think you used it, too. But everyone was totally blown away, and it's the best hike ever.
Yeah.
I think you took them just over wild country, which a lot of people haven't done before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gotten off, quote, trail. I know around here there aren't a lot of trails, but...
Yeah, it was...
It's a great feeling for folks.
Yeah, you had a great group, you know, to take out, and it was fun going over fires and plants and shelters with them.
Yeah. Yeah, one day.
Mm-hmm.
Not even half day. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I think we should fire up this thing and get deep into these cycles of hot and cold.
Yeah, that sounds like a plan. Yep.
All right.
Thank you, Trevor.
Thanks, dude.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
All right, there you go. That's Mr. Matt Graham on the first episode of 10 Laws with East Forest. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to give us a good review on iTunes. Don't give us a bad one. We don't need those. If you feel that way, you know, you can go listen to something else. And please say hi, info@eastforest.org. Tell your friends about it, all that good stuff. This music you're hearing in the background, the theme music, this is the song Code of 10, and it's off the East Forest album titled Orbits. I believe that came out in 2015, and it was for the AWOL Dance Company when they asked me to kind of rework a lot of my catalog, and so I was reworking the song 10 Laws and it became Code of 10. If you'd like to check out that track, you can pretty much find that one anywhere. And I will see you on the next episode. Keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit, but if you do, do it with grace.